This is Sportscaster.com's Open Mic with Johnny Kane on 760 WJR, featuring sports commentary and stories brought to you by the most compelling rising stars in sports broadcasting. Here's your host, Johnny Kane.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the show. It is Wednesday, June 25th, and this is Sportscaster.com's Open Mic. I'm your host, Johnny Kane. This is a show where we cover a wide range of topics involving sports on every level. Not your traditional sports talk radio, but more long-form interviews with athletes, coaches, other industry leaders to provide a deeper perspective. And the commentary you'll hear tonight over the next hour comes from the next generation of aspiring young broadcasters. On tonight's show, we'll discuss a landmark legal case that just settled. It's really going to change the way college athletics operate with respect to paying athletes. We'll also hear from an icon in women's professional hockey, that being Madison Packer, recently retired, but one of the best players of her generation, who's from Birmingham, Michigan. In addition to that, we'll hear from Lorenzo Pinilli after his record-setting performance in the Michigan Amateur Golf Tournament. Pinilli, one of the top rising young golfers in the state who attends Michigan State. But we begin with the NBA draft, which is taking place tonight in Brooklyn. And here to kick off the show is Carter Lutz, who is plugged in on the NBA scene. Carter, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. You can feel the energy for the draft in the air as I stand on the New York City streets.
Yeah, I was going to mention Carter Lutz joining us live on location from New York. The NBA draft is taking place in Brooklyn, not far from where you are. But what did you think about the finals, Game 7 with the Pacers and Oklahoma City Thunder? I thought it was a fabulous series. What was your takeaway?
I think the overall sense around the series is that people are pleased with it. I think the Thunder are the perfect example of how to build a contending team in the NBA in this era, and they just showed it on the court. So shout out to all the fans that stuck with these teams throughout the playoffs, because it's a long playoff season.
Yeah, it's a marathon. There's no question. It's like a second season entirely.
Yeah.
The Thunder actually have the 15th and 24th overall picks. The Pistons don't have a first-round pick this year. They'll draft 37th. That was a pick that they acquired in a trade with the Dallas Mavericks. And speaking of the Mavericks, the way the NBA draft lottery played out, the Mavs, who obviously made headlines with the Luka Doncic, Anthony Davis trade, the Mavericks end up with the first overall pick. In your opinion, is there any chance they don't go Cooper Flagg number one overall?
I think it's as surefire as LeBron to the Cavaliers in 2003. I think there's no other route you can go unless you wanted to trade the pick, but we know they're not doing that after they made a trade earlier in the season. Cooper Flagg will be a Maverick, and, I mean, he's a seriously hyped-up prospect.
Yeah, I think that's just it, right? The Mavs have the first overall pick. The Spurs have the second pick in this year's draft. The Spurs obviously have Wemby. They have De'Aaron Fox. It'll be interesting to see what they do. They obviously have a coaching change with Greg Popovich stepping down after forever. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. I will say this. It was recently announced that the Pistons will play the Dallas Mavericks in Mexico City on November 1st this year. So they're going to play the Mexico City game. So if they do get Cooper Flagg, this new-look Mavs team, that'll be fun to see the Pistons play them abroad. Again, that's coming up in November. So in addition to Flagg, a couple other names that we'll see, I think, in the first couple of picks. Rutgers has a couple of guys, Dylan Harper, Ace Bailey. Harper's a true guard. Ace Bailey's kind of a combo guard, but he could play small forward. VJ Edgecombe from Baylor, he's a combo guard. And then Con Knipple, maybe the second best player behind Cooper Flagg from Duke. Again, first round of the NBA draft is tonight. The second round will be coming up tomorrow. And Matt O'Brien is a part of the Sportscaster program, very knowledgeable about the game. You can find him on social media under the handle Boston Buckets, if that tells you anything about the team he likes to root for. Thoughtful commentary on this year's NBA draft from Matt O'Brien. All right, well, hey, man, I really appreciate you joining us live on the streets in New York. That is Carter Lutz from the University of Miami. He's part of the Sportscaster program. It's going to be compelling theater watching the NBA draft unfold. So without further ado, here is Matt O'Brien with his NBA draft commentary.
When we're talking about this year's draft, we absolutely need to start with the number one overall pick. Crazy draft lottery. It falls to the Dallas Mavericks. They had the lowest odds in the lottery to get this pick. And that's pretty crazy because they were in the play-in. They could have made the playoffs. So pretty crazy that they end up with the number one pick. because a lot of people would argue that they were pretty close to contending. They have a lot of good players. They've got Anthony Davis, Kyrie Irving, Klay Thompson kind of on the way out, but still pretty good option. The number one overall pick should be Cooper Flagg. This guy has been expected to be the number one pick since before he even went to college. He did go to Duke last season, and he had a pretty stellar season, so he's really locked in at that number one spot. Another thing that we're looking at in this draft is other trade madness. So the number two pick is possessed by the San Antonio Spurs. And we know that the San Antonio Spurs have a very good roster. They have Victor Wembanyama. They just acquired De'Aaron Fox this past season. And they have a pretty stacked roster, and they're ready to compete. They want to use Victor Wembanyama's years to the best of their ability. So we know that they're going to be looking to trade either this number two pick, and they also possess the number 14 pick for one of the two big stars on the market, that being Kevin Durant and Giannis Antetokounmpo. There's a lot of talks that KD is pretty much solidified as a Spur already. And realistically, I think they would trade the 14th pick for KD, but they wouldn't trade the number two pick for him. That's a little bit high value. But if they are going to try to trade for Giannis, that's where they would trade the number two pick. But pretty interesting, if they do trade the 14th overall pick for KD, they still possess that number two pick. So the Spurs could be very dangerous next season. Another really interesting thing about this draft lottery is that some of the worst teams fell out of the top three. Our top three is the Mavericks, the Spurs, and the Philadelphia 76ers, who are all pretty decent rosters. And our 4, 5, 6 picks go Hornets, Jazz, and Wizards, who are all pretty awful. So it's interesting to see that the worst teams are not going to be getting the best players. And I don't really know if this is necessarily good or bad for the league. I think it is exciting to see that some of the best teams are going to get better. And I think that's what the league kind of wants. But it is kind of interesting that some of these bad teams are going to continue to be bad because they're not getting the best prospects. And another really important thing about this draft is the Oklahoma City Thunder. And they have pick 15 and pick 24. So they're going to be getting even deeper in this draft. And we know about the Oklahoma City Thunder is that they have more first rounders in the years coming. So they're going to be super scary. And they have a lot of options they could do in this draft. With pick 15 and 24, they could trade up, get a higher pick. They could trade out of the draft and get other really solid prospects. And it's pretty scary that they're already this good and they're going to be getting better this offseason.
Again, that was sportscaster.com's Matt O'Brien. NBA draft taking place tonight. Pistons don't own a first round pick this year, so they'll make the 37th overall pick in round two, which takes place tomorrow. If you follow college athletics at all, you know the landscape has dramatically shifted. Television revenue certainly through the roof. Geographic conferences no longer a priority as different conferences are structured the way that they are. Earlier this month, a federal judge approved a settlement between the NCAA and former college athletes where the NCAA has agreed to provide almost $3 billion in back pay to former and current college athletes. And it also allows schools to directly pay athletes for the first time. The revenue essentially comes from media rights and the revenue that they're going to pay here. So it basically goes back almost 10 years, and universities themselves will now directly handle name, image, likeness. Giovanni Mascheri is a graduate from Oakland University here in Michigan, and he provides commentary on how this decision impacts universities that operate in the mid-major budgets, universities like Oakland U.
What's going on, sportscaster.com? My name is Giovanni Mascheri, and the news that we've all been waiting for and have basically been planning on arriving has finally officially arrived. The NCAA agreed in a settlement to provide $2.8 billion back to former and current college athletes while now being allowed to pay them directly for the first time. Universities will be able to pay their student athletes. So amateurism in college sports, at least at the Division I level, is no more. There's now money involved, much more money involved. And going off an article written by Joshua Lenz on theconversation.com from the University of Iowa, breaks it down nicely in terms of the terms of the settlement. I'll run through them quickly just so we're all on the same page. The NCAA and its conferences will distribute about $2.8 billion in media rights revenue back to thousands of student athletes who competed since 2016. So it goes back about 10 years for these athletes. In addition to that, universities themselves will now be allowed to enter name, image, and likeness deals with their student athletes. So it's no longer just the NIL collectives or boosters or whichever that are allowed to pay for NIL deals. The universities directly are able to. So it's not an employment status for the student athletes. It's just the universities are now able to foot the bill on that kind of stuff. In addition to that, each university that opts into the settlement can disperse up to $20.5 million to student athletes in the 2025-2026 academic year, a number that Lens writes is likely to increase over the years. In addition to that, athletes currently in NIL agreements with other entities, those deals will now be subject to a third-party review to determine fair market value of it. So they basically, it's not the NCAA that's going to be making those rulings, but they have a third party that's going to try and make sure that these deals aren't absolutely insane and allow for a fair market. And finally, in addition to that, the NCAA's maximum program scholarship limit will now be replaced with a maximum team roster size for universities that choose to take part in the settlement. That's one that sticks out to me. No longer is it you can have your walk-ons fight to be on the team and be great parts of it. There's now a hard roster limit when it comes to these sports. So now that we're all on the same page, I'll spare you guys the entire history of it. If you want to read Lenz's article, it's well written. You could go and do that yourself. But as far as my thoughts on it, I get worried when it comes to this kind of stuff in college sports. You know, my background is in, I went to Oakland University and was heavily involved in the athletic department there. So for me, my perspective of going to a university that doesn't even have college football, men's basketball is their biggest program. And even then, the program is on the smaller side. They only bring in about $18 million of revenue a year as far as the entire athletic department. So the money side is very low compared to a lot of the other D1 universities that are going to be heavily involved in this new direct-to-pay world of college sports. So for a university like Oakland, for example, that brings in $18 million a year, where's the $20.5 million going to come from? That's not money that's just lying around. So there's a lot of D1 universities like Oakland at the level of Oakland, mid-major schools. I don't know if they're going to be able to put up that kind of money. And a lot of programs are even cutting teams in order to try and, you know, balance the budget a little bit. For example, we'll stay within the Horizon League. Purdue, Fort Wayne, and Cleveland State have started to cut programs. Now, it's not clear whether it's directly as a result of this. Those cuts were made before the settlement was agreed upon. But there's still like entire sport programs are being cut in order for colleges and universities to try and manage this new almost, you know, pretty much a requirement at this point. Yes, they can opt out of it. But if you're a D1 university trying to, you know, be competitive and relevant and get good talent, you have to opt into this. You can't just sit back and let other universities pay their athletes while you just sit in the 50s, you know, in the 1950s and just pretend that it's still amateur. You can't do that anymore. So a lot of universities, you know, their arms twisted into this. So not only will many programs likely be cut, but in addition to that, when it comes to the scholarship limits, that changes the dynamic of teams too, because walk-ons are such an incredible part of college sports, and many a great stories have been had from the walk-on position that, you know, in a roster limit like this, you basically have a budget to pay your roster. You know, there's not going to be a lot of room for that anymore, I don't believe. And finally, it was brought up in the article that there could be some potential Title IX issues when it comes to, you know, how universities disperse the money. Will some of it mostly go to men's sports? Well, does that violate Title IX? So to wrap things up, I see a lot of potential issues that come up with this settlement, especially when you look to the lower side of college athletics, that makes this very concerning for the many that go unnoticed to the benefit of the few that get on TV. We'll see how college sports goes.
Solid insight from Giovanni Mascheri from Oakland University. It is an ever-changing landscape in college athletics, and we'll continue to cover stories like this one. It's hard to know where it's going to go, where it's going to end. All we do know is that it is going to continue to evolve. Our next guest on the program is Lyric Sloan, a student at Michigan State University, who had a chance to talk with Michigan State athlete Lorenzo Pinilli on the Michigan State golf team. Lyric, good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it's always great to be back.
This Lorenzo, he's good. I think, you know, there's a lot of us that play golf, mostly like weekend golfers that maybe listen to the show. And maybe at one point in time you say, yeah, I'd like to play a professional golf at some point. And there are a lot of great collegiate players. And obviously Lorenzo was a great prep player at Brother Rice before he got to East Lansing. For those listening that may not know, the Michigan amateur at Belvedere Golf Club in Charlevoix was just played. He shot 63, which is the lowest round in stroke play qualifying in history. And then 130 for his stroke play total. That's the best by one shot in tournament history. Like, he's playing some of his best golf. And we just got into the first few days of summer. So the sky's the limit for Lorenzo Pinilli.
I know. I was really happy seeing him breaking records, especially because he said that he has very specific goals lined out for himself.
When you talked to him about, you know, some of the advice for younger players, do you remember what he had said?
I mean, I found it so interesting because you're a one-man band in golf. So you really have to have a specific mindset to be able to reset by yourself, because it's not a cohesive team. So you really have to build the mentality to be able to be successful in golf. But not only that, but you're out on that course for 8 hours. So you have to be prepared to put in all the hours, because not a lot of people might think about that.
Yeah, it is very individual. You've got to be able to reset in between each shot and to be at your best in order for the team to find success. And yeah, to your point, I think whether you're playing at the prep level, college, or even into the pros, it's the time that is spent on the course. All right, here is Eric Sloan from Michigan State University talking with Lorenzo Pinilli, Michigan State golfer, about how he got started on his path from Brother Rice to East Lansing, junior golf to college golf, and everything in between.
You have quite a different story. We're not going to necessarily go too much into detail, but obviously your parents came here to give you guys opportunity from the Philippines, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this must be such a special moment for you. You're here at Michigan State, a D1 school, and your brother's also committed to GVSU for golf as well. So what a cool moment this must be for you. When did you come to America? Were you born here?
I was born here. Okay, first generation. Cool. So.
Did your parents motivate you from an early age to use the opportunities that you could get? Like, were you naturally good at golf, or how did this come about?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember starting, but I mean, there's always the stories that my dad gave me. He was into golf. He moved here, got into it, was in business and stuff. So he was into it and he's watching it. And so I picked up like a sticks or something, trying to copy the TV, and he gave me clubs and I was hitting balls. And so from there, I just kind of kept
going.
So
you were doing it right
away?
Yeah,
I mean, I just kind of just came naturally, I guess you can say.
Okay, so you went to Brother Rice High School. Mm-hmm. And from those moments at Brother Rice, I know you won awards for your time there. Did you know that you could really have something special for golf?
I think when I was working a lot during COVID, just because there was no school, that's all I did, played a bunch of tournaments. And so I started to really love it and see a future with it. And so I kind of just kept that and I just took it and ran. And so throughout high school, just doing my best, found some success. And then in college as well. I struggled a little bit though in college.
What were the biggest struggles for you? Do you think it was just because you're entering a whole different level?
Yeah, it was definitely different. Like, the competition is way more competitive. You have a bad day in junior golf, you find yourself like middle pack, but if you have a bad day in college golf, everybody's so good that you're literally at the bottom. And so it was really tough for me to see that as a freshman coming off of a really successful senior year, seeing my name at the bottom and struggling. I just kind of mentally lost my confidence.
But do you think sophomore year you're back on track?
Sophomore year, I had a tough first semester and I was just like, all right, I just got to do something. And so first tournament of the second season. So we have two seasons. First tournament of the second season, didn't play great. And then the second tournament of the season, I won it. So you kind of go from zero to hero real quick. And then from there, I just gained all my confidence back. And so from there, I just took it and I started playing solid.
Yeah, it kind of gives you more motivation if you're always winning. Yeah. Like, it's like a Tom Brady story. You know, Tom Brady had to go through adversity to be the star that he was. So I think that you're able to pick it back up and learn from everyone else around you. If you don't have those tough moments, success wouldn't be as sweet as it is today. I have a question about your brother. Do you ever coach him, or were you guys both naturally good?
I feel like when we were younger, I was more like a competitive thing. He didn't want to lose to me. And so now he kind of saw my journey going out, being successful, and then struggling, and then coming back. He kind of saw that. And he was in a little bit of a slump recently, so he's kind of asked for coaching. Just kind of helped him as much as I can in the mental side and, like, the technical side of the golf swing.
Yeah, I was going to say, so there's a statistic about golf. It says that it's 90% mental. I think that every sport is mental in their own way, but how do you think that golf is more mental in a way than other sports?
Yeah, I mean, you're by yourself out there. You're not relying on anybody else, especially in college. Like, you don't get a caddy. Nobody's helping you besides your coaches. So you're going to have some holes where the coaches are helping someone else and you're doing it alone. So at the end of the day, every single shot's on you. Every single decision's on you. And so there's just a lot more pressure, I feel like, on yourself, especially if you have high expectations. You want to perform the best. You want to hit the best shot every time. And if you struggle and you fail to see that, it's really hard because, like, again, everything is on you. And so I feel like confidence and belief in yourself is huge, because even if you mess up, you can kind of be like, okay, yeah, I just messed up that one time. Let's get the next one. And being able to do that and have that high confidence is kind of key.
Yeah, as you're saying, you know, it's a one-man band when you're out on that course. It's mm-hmm. not a football team and you have your O-line defending you. Now I want to get into, you're an athlete at Michigan State. Do you get NIL deals? Do you get sponsorships? I mean, it must be such a cool opportunity for you to collaborate with people, or Michigan State as is of itself.
Yeah, so I don't have anything individually. I feel like in the golf world, it's really hard to get that. I mean, you have to pretty much be like a top 50 guy to get like really good deals. I'm sure you can get like your own side deals as well just by knowing people. But I know that we have a team deal, which is really nice. That always helps. And then other than NIL, we have like a really good donor base. And so they take us out to play and they treat us well.
So what are you doing during off season?
So now it's golf season for like everybody else. So everybody's on their own, playing their own tournaments. And so that's summer. But our true off season's end of October and November to like February. So that's like the only time you really don't have anything. So other than that, you're playing golf either on your own or you're playing golf with a team. So it's kind of like an 8-month deal. So it's really tiring, and which is kind of important to like get yourself fine mentally, you know, not to get burned out like that. I mean, you could say this is off season, but I'm still golfing, playing tournaments.
And do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, I'm outside just playing golf, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with that for me.
Do you have any on-course superstitions that you do, any rituals that you practice?
As of recently, I've kind of got into it a little bit. Like, okay, honestly, I didn't care, but I only play like even number balls.
Okay.
So a box of balls that I get comes in 1, 2, 3, and 4. So I only play the 2s and 4s.
Is there a reason for that?
I just like,
you every, just feel like
I just feel like, no, I mean, I start off the round with a 2 or 4, right? And I've kind of paid attention because I've played like odd before. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like I start better and I just play better. And then as soon as like that ball gets like scuffed, I switch it out. I remember one time I switched it out with an odd number. I made a bogey. So right back.
It works.
Yeah. I mean,
so now I'm just going to play a little game. I'm just going to give you like little prompts. You're just going to rapid fire your answers. Okay. What's your favorite club in the bag?
Putter.
Go-to pre-round meal?
Eggs.
Oh, that's so valid.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Dream golf course?
Cypress Point.
What's your favorite?
My favorite I've ever played? I'm going to say Portrush. Mm. Royal Portrush in Ireland.
Would you rather walk or ride?
Like, if it's tournament, I'd rather walk. But if it's just with the boys and we're just having fun, I'd ride.
Yeah. Tiger or Rory?
Tiger.
Favorite major tournament?
Masters. Pretty cool.
Favorite golf brand?
Titleist.
Bucket hat or visor?
Bucket hat all day.
Most used phrase during a round?
So basically, if your ball is going towards the tree, which is not good,
you gotta
yell Reynolds right when it hits the tree and it gets a good kick. So yeah, everybody on the team uses it.
Music or no music during practice rounds?
No music.
Who's winning a putting contest? You or your coach?
Me.
Favorite Spartan tradition?
I really like the Izzone. Yeah. I really like it. Like, I've never been in it, but I really want it.
Okay, one course that you'd never play again.
That I'd never play again?
Yeah.
I'd never want to play Wingate again.
And why is that?
It was just so quirky, and, like, there's a bunch of, like, twists. Like, I just want to hit it as far as I can down there. Like, you have to lay up everywhere. And also, the bunkers weren't great.
Okay, Lorenzo, for the last closing question, I'm sure a lot of people that are aspiring to be a golfer at the collegiate level that you are, do you have any advice?
If you're a younger kid, I'd probably just say to have fun with it at least. You know, if you're not having fun, then it's going to be hard to get better because you got to put in a lot of hours and you got to enjoy it. And so you got to be ready for being out on the golf course for like 8 hours. And so putting a lot of hard work and just playing as many tournaments as you can, I think getting experience in that level of just being competitive is huge. And the more experience you get, the better you'll be.
What keeps you motivated?
Yeah, I mean, I truly do want to play at the pro level, kind of seeing myself climb up the different levels. You know, now I'm at the collegiate level. there's always another benchmark to meet. And so I want to keep going for sure. So mostly self-motivated, and I do it for my family too.
Yeah. You just got Big Ten Player of the Week. Mm-hmm. I can tell you put in the good work and you have a good mindset. All right. Thank you to everyone who listened on tonight's WJR Open Mic.
Again, that was Michigan State's Lyric Sloan in a candid conversation with Michigan State golfer Lorenzo Pinilli, who shot the lowest round in stroke play qualifying in history at the Michigan Am here recently at Belvedere Golf Club in Charlevoix, Michigan. This is a young golfer who is on the rise, who one day, you never know, we may see in professional golf. A lot of you probably grew up playing ice hockey or maybe even street hockey like I did. It's typically a sport that's associated as a male sport. You know, weren't a ton of opportunities with respect to girl-specific youth leagues or even collegiately not that long ago. But that is changing. Women's professional hockey is growing at a rapid pace, as we've seen with the Professional Women's Hockey League that is still in its infancy, but is expanding. Our next guest, Gavin Velesovic from De La Salle Collegiate High School in Warren, Michigan. Gavin, welcome back to the show.
What's going on, Johnny?
You had a chance to talk with Madison Packer, who recently retired from the Professional Women's Hockey League. What can you tell us about Madison?
She started just like how any other young ice hockey player would start. At 5 years old, she started playing in a boys ice hockey league, travel hockey. Then she got up to Marion High School and then played Little Caesars AAA, a common team around the area with boys in the league. And then that's kind of a minor hockey league, they consider it around here. And then she was inducted into the Marion and the Catholic League Hall of Fame, which was a pretty big honor. And then she went out to Wisconsin with scholarship to play club ice hockey. She helped them win the 2011 National Collegiate Women's Hockey Tournament.
Yeah, she can play. You know what I mean? She's got the accolades to go with it. And then Madison Packer, I know she played in the NWHL and the PHF prior to the PWHL, throwing a lot of acronyms at the listeners. But how long has the Professional Women's Hockey League been around?
So the idea came about in the early 2020s, and then in 2023, they got the financial backing. And then finally, with six teams, they started in January 2024.
I know they're due to expand here. What was your biggest takeaway in talking with Madison? Because as good as she was as an ice hockey player, it's more about her advocacy for effecting change more than just a trip down memory lane about her playing career.
Sure. And I think the biggest takeaway I had was that it's going to be a domino effect. For example, if Michigan got a women's hockey team the next year or two, then Michigan State would follow. And then we'd see maybe a little financial backing for a major team. And then you could get professionals in there.
Yeah, Madison Packer, advocacy has become a big part of her story. That will be her legacy outside of the arena, affecting change in her community.
We're welcoming Madison Packer here from the PWHL, part of a giant professional women's hockey league. She's a prominent figure and sticking up for the Women's Hockey League rights and all the players' rights. And let's start off right from the top, Madison. You've been a huge women's hockey advocate and you've been a part of the movement for years. What's the biggest difference you've seen since the beginning to right now?
Well, I think number one, we have a CBA now. So the players have protections, they have rights. There are certain things in place that ensure that we have benefits. That wasn't always the case. You know, seasons one and two, we didn't even have workman's comp in the league, which is something that like is absolutely essential. So there's guarantees in place now that protect players. There are guarantees that compensation is going to go up year over year. Along with that, the investment group, the Mark Walter group, they own the Dodgers, Billie Jean King. They're heavily invested in the success and the growth of the league. So that's promising. I think probably in the next 2, 3, 4 years, you'll start to see these teams get sold off, and then the league is just going to explode even more because you're going to have individual investment in teams and there's going to be a vested interest in wanting your team to succeed and be better.
When you started off, like as a kid, you know, how we all do, kind of thinking about what we want to do in sports. Were you certain when you started you wanted to do hockey? Was that like a, I know I want to do this type thing?
Yeah, I mean, I always loved playing hockey. It was different then, right? Because there was no women's professional league. So like, I think, yeah. Most of my counterparts, we grew up thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to play in the NHL, which is still has, I mean, Manon Rayon played in a game as a goalie, but it's just not a realistic goal. Like the women aren't going to play in the NHL, but they don't have to anymore. So for me, it was always, I wanted to be on the national team, be an Olympian, but even growing up, you had to go to a game to be able to see it. So like I went to the Salt Lake City Olympics in 2002. That was the only way I could see like high level women's hockey because it wasn't on television. So I think that's a big difference now too, is that, you know, young girls have the ability to grow up wanting to be Hillary Knight, Madison Packer, Kendall Coyne. They don't have to grow up wanting to be Brad Marchand or the male equivalent of what they are able to see now.
Like you were talking about young athletes and being inspired a little bit. What would you say to them that are kind of dreaming, maybe get to the PWHL, especially our women listeners here? What would you think is your best piece of advice getting up to the professional league or even the collegiate level?
Yeah, I think that one, to keep having fun. But if you have a goal and you're willing to sacrifice and stick to it, it's attainable, right? Because the league exists and it's there. I think the biggest thing, especially, you know, playing a predominantly male sport, you're always going to have people tell you that you can't do something. And it's usually people who are jealous that they're watching you do what they can't. So I think just if you have a goal and you have a dream, stick to it and don't let the negative energy and the people telling you that you can't do something prevent you from trying.
Awesome. You've obviously had a ton of success, not only at Wisconsin and the PWHL, and you've been a huge advocate off of the ice, from speaking up for players' rights to mental health, all of that. Why has advocacy become such a large part of your career?
For me, I learned once I got a bigger platform on the professional level, the ability that I had to make a difference outside of the arena. And that was my legacy as a player was going to be far more impactful if I could affect change in my community, not just on the fun side of the glass. And, you know, unfortunately, I experienced some loss in my personal life. My wife has struggled with her mental health. So it's just things that have become more and more common and gotten closer and closer to home. You know, I have a lot of friends whose kids don't have access to sport in the way that they should. And I feel like I have a platform and the ability to speak out about those things. And I think that at the end of the day, regardless of what you do for a living, we're all human beings. And I think that the more we normalize conversations that are difficult to have, the more comfortable everyone is in having that conversation in their own community. And so that's kind of where it started. And I think I found that the more I talked about things and the more welcoming we made our arenas and the more we leaned into groups that maybe weren't always as seen or as heard, it made playing more enjoyable. It made our locker room more enjoyable. Our team was more successful because it was just a much lighter like air in the room. And so I think that that's the most important part of sport is the ability to make an impact on someone's life. Like looking back, I can maybe remember a couple goals that I scored that were like really cool. And obviously I remember winning the big championships, but the things that stick out more in my mind are the community events that we did or the games where fans came up afterwards and they were so excited for whatever the initiative was that we were doing. And so at the end of the day, that's the most rewarding part of the job.
That's awesome. Quick fun one. You've played with a ton of players over your time. If you had the chance to create your top five, top six, whatever, in a lineup, what would be your ultimate lineup?
Ooh, I guess I'll go right now, but I've got to throw Rebecca Russo in there. I'll go me, Russo, Gwyneth Phillips in net, Kayla Barnes on D, Megan Keller on D.
Awesome. That's your top five, top six type shifting on the line?
Yeah.
Awesome. And then we see women's hockey is really growing. Like you said, we're getting more investment in the sport and even people from investors like in the Dodgers and trying to get more private investment with sold out crowds or more ownership, and more young girls are obviously picking up the sport. Where do you see women's hockey moving to in the future?
I think initially just start filling the buildings that we have. Hockey is interesting and unique in that there are a lot of barriers to entry from the grassroots level. It's a very expensive sport to play. It's not super accessible dependent on where you live. So there's a huge burden on the people at the top to continue to make the game accessible at the grassroots level so that girls want to continue to play, because we need that pipeline to continue. You're seeing on the NHL side, viewership is down a little bit, enrollment numbers are down a little bit. Fortunately, women's hockey is booming right now. So I think that the girls at the top need to continue to give back to the game and develop young players. And then as long as that continues to happen and the pipeline stays full, like I would love to see more college teams pop up. I think the University of Michigan, it's ridiculous that they don't have a women's team. I think once they get a team, Michigan State will get a team. But the hardship is it just hasn't been as popular a sport because of the accessibility component. But once that happens and some of those schools start to get teams, then ideally you would have more women's pro teams. Like you could easily right now have 8 to 10 teams in the women's pro league because there's enough talent right now to substantiate that. But there just isn't the demand for the viewership. So they need to fill the buildings that exist and then continue to expand.
Thank you. Appreciate it a lot, Madison, for your time today. Ladies and gentlemen, again on Sportscaster, Madison Packer here with us. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, really amazing to see how different athletes, you know, once the playing careers are done, what they decide to do after they hang them up. And for someone like Madison Packer, obviously an advocate in a big way for not just women's professional hockey, but women's sports in general. Also want to thank Lyric Sloan for catching up with Lorenzo Panilli from the Michigan State golf team. He was coming off a fabulous performance at the Michigan Am earlier this month. Giovanni Mascheri, great commentary on that landmark legal case as now the NCAA agreeing to pay $2.8 billion in back pay to former and current college athletes. And our thanks to Matt O'Brien and also Carter Lutz with the NBA draft taking place tonight in Brooklyn. Some commentary on how that thing may shake out. So we appreciate everybody tuning in this week. Fun show. Hope you learned a few things. And we'll continue to bring you some compelling storylines as we do this every week on Wednesday nights from 8 to 9 here on WJR. Until next time, I'm Johnny Kane. We say thanks for listening.